I next met with Dr. Gilles Salles from the Claude Bernard University in Lyon, France. And to begin, he discussed a 56-year-old patient from his practice.
That was a patient I saw like probably 3 years and a half ago or 4 years ago. This gentleman was a quite active man. He was working as a businessman. He had no significant previous medical history, and he developed superficial lymphadenopathy and at some time get a little bit some tiredness, fatigue, and dyspnea. So he went to see his general practitioner, and a biopsy was performed and showed, if I recall well, follicular lymphoma grade 2. He also got a CT scan performed, which showed disseminated lymphadenopathy, subdiaphragmatic and infradiaphragmatic, as well as bilateral pleural effusion. And he was talking with a hemato-oncologist close to the place he worked with, who talked to him about immunochemotherapy, but wanted to come back to me to see if there were any particular options. He realized this was a disease that was in need of treatment.
Any other symptoms that he had? Any pulmonary symptoms?
No, he didn't have really a little bit of cough, but I think essentially dyspnea for the usual life efforts. I mean, like climbing stairs or walking rapidly. And he started to complain about that.
So using this case as a sort of an example, can you talk a little bit about what you see as the most important considerations in the evaluation of a patient with untreated follicular lymphoma?
So when I see a patient with untreated follicular lymphoma, one of the first questions is, what is the disease extent? What is the bulk of the disease? What are the symptoms associated with the disease? Because we do know that depending on these factors, we may choose different treatment options that will start with watchful waiting for a couple of patients who don't need treatment immediately, to rituximab single agent, or chemotherapy plus rituximab, or are the reasonable new options a combination of lenalidomide and rituximab. So I think this is important to check what are the symptoms and how the quality of life of the patient is eventually impaired by the disease so that we can discuss the different options with the patient.
What about the type of biopsy? What kind of biopsy did this man have, and what kind of biopsy do you want to see?
So for follicular lymphoma, it's very important to have preferably an excisional biopsy or a good biopsy of a good lymph node. Eventually, a core biopsy can be sufficient if these lymph nodes that are in the abdomen or something like that, in order to make sure you have a reasonable representation of the pathology. Because sometimes, in large masses of follicular lymphoma, there may be places where the lymphoma start to transform. And if you have only a core biopsy, which is of very limited size, the pathology sometimes may have difficulties in precising the grade of the lymphoma.
What about the issue of grade? How much inter-observer variation is there? And how do you approach patients with grade 3A and B disease?
So patients with grade 1 and grade 2, basically patients with an indolent disease, which can be treated with multiple options. When the lymph node shows a certain percentage of large cell centroblasts, these are called grade 3, and 3A when the cells are sparse, while 3B when they are cohesive in the pathology sample. And this patient with grade 3B follicular lymphoma have a clinical behavior that looks much more like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, and all hemato-oncologists will like to treat this patient like diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. So I think when we have grade 1, 2, or grade 1, 2, because sometimes pathologists can't really distinguish between both, I think it's fair to trust the pathologist. When you have a grade 3 lymphoma, follicular lymphoma, it's good to have eventually a second opinion or an expert pathologist looking at the slide, because between grade 3 and 3B, it's sometimes difficult, and the way you manage the patients may differ. So it's very important when a grade 3 is discussed by the pathologist to really look at the report or eventually ask for an expert pathologist to look at the samples.
What about grade 3A?
So grade 3A is basically when it's confirmed by an expert pathologist, behaves like grade 1 and 2, and you can apply to this patient exactly the same treatment you apply for patient with grade 1 and 2 follicular lymphoma.
What do we know about inter-observer grading? You mentioned expert pathologist. Where do you see the discrepancy, and how much discrepancy is there?
When pathologists are reporting grade 1 and 2, I think the concordance between the different pathologists are probably greater than 90%. As soon as we are starting about grade 3 and grade 3A, 3B, I think it probably decreased to 60, 65%. So I think it's better in this case to make sure the samples were first really representative of the tumor and secondly seen by pathologists that sees a sufficient number of follicular lymphoma or lymphoma in general per year.
So maybe you can comment a little bit. You mentioned the issue of in patients with advanced disease, rituximab alone, chemoimmunotherapy, or R-squared as a new option. I'm going to ask you sort of to go through those data and also watch and wait. So maybe you can dissect out a little bit. Let's talk about differentiating a case where you would observe, a case where you would use R alone, and a case where you would use R chemoimmunotherapy or R squared. Can you talk about how you decide between those three options?
So we do know that follicular lymphoma is an indolent disease and that some patients may not need immediate intervention, and that immediate intervention in this patient has not necessarily shown to prolong the survival. So when we see a patient that does not present with symptoms related to the disease, and when the workup doesn't demonstrate very large tumor bulk, and the biology is also normal or subnormal, we can decide either to watch the patient or eventually to give the patient rituximab single agent. Both options are acceptable. Obviously, if you decide to watch the patient, you have to trust the patient that he or she will establish a good relationship with the oncologist in order to be complying with the follow-up necessary, because you will have to watch the patient maybe 3-4 times a year during the first year and then at least every 6 months, and maybe after that 1 year, because you want to detect if there is a progression of the disease that may need another intervention. Using rituximab single agent in this patient is also an option. I will use in this case 4 weekly infusions followed by 4 additional consolidation infusion, 1 every 2 months. This is an approach that will stabilize the disease and most of the patient will actually respond to this kind of therapy, but after 3-4 years, the disease may recur. You can adopt this kind of options for the patient which have what asymptomatic or defined with a GELF low tumor burden criteria, which is usually small nodes, not greater than 3 centimeters or not greater than 7 centimeters, no pleural effusion and normal LDH, normal beta 2 microglobulin. If the patient present with a bulk, like a large tumor or symptomatic of his disease or some parameters, cytopenia or elevated LDH or eventually beta 2 microglobulin, then you may decide for a more active intervention, which until recently has been essentially rituximab of chemotherapy, either bendamustine or CHOP or eventually CVP. Recently, the investigators at MD Anderson have established that the combination of lenalidomide and rituximab was a reasonable option in some patients. And this regimen, also called R-square, was assessed in a series of patients in phase 2 study and more recently reported in a phase 3 study as giving similar results to rituximab and chemotherapy.
So in terms of these same issues, what about the elderly, frail patient, 80-year-old patient, frail, maybe some minor comorbidities? Are you more aggressive about, for example, using R alone to try to sort of delay the patient having to receive chemotherapy?
With elderly and frail patient, it's always a difficult choice and discussion. You can use rituximab alone because obviously you will have less side effects of the treatment But you may also have the risk, if this is a patient with a significant bulk, to have difficulties in controlling the disease. And if the disease comes back 3-4 years later, further difficulties in treating this patient with a more intensive regimen. So I think there are options such as rituximab CVP or rituximab with bendamustine, assuming you can eventually decrease the dose of bendamustine, or even CHOP with a diminished dose of anthracycline. And I think if the patient is really symptomatic and has bulk disease, for this frail patient, I will prefer to have a chemo immunotherapy which have lower dose, rather than keeping the patient on rituximab with the risk of seeing a transformation and not able, for instance, to treat the patient again. But obviously, it's an individual discussion patient per patient with the patient with relatives and the way he can tolerate different interventions.
So you mentioned the relevance trial looking at lenalidomide and rituximab that was presented at the ASCO meeting. Can you kind of go through what the most important findings were from the study? And right now, clinically, how you see, sort of putting aside the regulatory issues that always come up, but just basically in terms of clinical decision-making, how you decide between using, say, R-squared, for example, compared to R-chemo?
So the relevance trial, which was presented at ASCO and published recently in the New England Journal of Medicine, compared in 500 patients each arm, either R-square, a combination of lenalidomide rituximab or rituximab and chemotherapy, which included patients either treated with rituximab bendamustine or rituximab CHOP. The response rate, carefully evaluated at 6 months, was not different between the two regimen, either R-square or R-chemo, and the progression-free survival was nearly identical. These are early results which give confidence to use the R-square regimen in patients that were usually treated with immunochemotherapy. You have, however, to balance a couple of things. The side effects of R-chemo are the usual one, alopecia, neutropenia with R-CHOP, eventually some fatigue or some infection risk with bendamustine. While with R-square, there are some patients suffering from rashes, eventually some diarrhea or other GI effect. In addition to that, the way the treatment with R-square was designed in relevance was 6 months with a full dose of lenalidomide, which was 20 mg 21 days out of 28, followed by 1 year at lower dose, 10 milligrams, and an additional year of rituximab, which gives basically 2.5 years of active treatment with a combination of both drugs for 1.5 years. The R-chemo arm was derived from the PRIMA trial, so 6 months of immunochemotherapy and then one infusion of rituximab every 2 months for 2 years. So this has also to be balanced because it's likely that during the next year after the first 6 months, the patient may have a little bit more symptom with R-square than with a rituximab single agent, but maybe better tolerated during the first 6 months. So the length of the treatment should be also taken into consideration when discussing these options with the patients.
I'm curious, what do you think is the optimal, if you're going to use R-squared, would you use it exactly the same way as it was used in the relevance trial? There have been other schedules, or some people use a year, year and a half. What exactly, I don't know if you're able to or whether you have actually done that. What do you think the optimal regimen of R-squared is?
Well, it is difficult to know if R-squared is only one single regimen that fits to all or if it can be adapted. The usual way to use R-square is an induction with 4 infusions of rituximab the first months. At the same time, lenalidomide is given at 20 milligrams, so a little bit lower dose than in multiple myeloma, 20 milligrams per day, 21 days out of 28. And this is given in monthly cycle up to 6 cycles. I think we should always stick to these inductions, because lowering significantly the amount of lenalidomide or sparing some rituximab infusion may have less efficacy. The goal is obviously to reach the best response. When you have reached a complete response in patients who didn't have a very progressive disease or not many symptoms related to the disease, there might be an option to consider of continuing with rituximab maintenance without necessarily continuing with lenalidomide, as this was initially developed by MD Anderson, who treated the patient for 1 year, 1 year and a half. On the other hand, the comparison with our chemo was made with this regimen. So if you want to make sure that you achieve the same result as the one obtained with our chemo, because you feel that the patient is really in need of prolonged control of the disease, you may prefer to stick with the consolidation of first year with lower dose of lenalidomide and rituximab. Obviously, we don't know what is perfect here and what will provide alterations of this regimen on the long term. But I think if we want to substitute R-square to our chemo, I will try to stick as close as possible to the scheme that was published in Relevance.
I've been kind of surprised at the reaction to Relevance. I kind of think that it was sort of exactly what people expected. So no surprise, I don't think. But afterwards, I figured people are going to start using R-squared because it was less toxic. And yet, I'm not sure that's happening. And actually, some people are saying, well, our chemo is not necessarily more toxic than R-squared. When you think about, again, quality life issues and complications, comparing these two approaches in your own practice, how do you compare them?
Well, I think that both options have some kind of toxicities, and those toxicities are all manageable for these kind of patients. When you provide our chemo for the patients have to come more often for infusions in the hospital. If you give Benda, there are Benda infusions for 2 days. We know that Benda sometimes have associated with some fatigues, sometimes with some GI effects. Neutropenia is mild with Benda, if any. However, with previous result with Benda, we do know that there is a susceptibility to infections and eventually opportunistic infections, which indicate that we need to be a little bit careful when giving our Benda to frail patients or patients over 60, 70. With R-square, the regimen is rather easy to manage as long as you are a little bit used to use lenalidomide and explain to the patient the side effects he or she may encounter. There are sometimes rashes that are uncoated with this drug. You can interrupt the administration of lenalidomide for a few days, restart with antihistaminic drugs, and this is well manageable. We have some patients that have had kind of muscle pains or cramps or things like that, and this exists with lenalidomide, we know it. There is also a little bit of neutropenia, which is usually not associated with complications such as infections, but is here. And I will say that some patients will tolerate extremely well R-square, and I have had patients like the gentleman I described who went through very well, other young patients that went well, even when they had quite significantly large amount of tumor, but also had difficulties to tolerate for whatever reason. And you may say, well, maybe our chemo will have been easier. So I think it's a real question of discussing with the patient what are their goals. There is another consideration that needs to be taken into account. I personally favor when using our chemo, using rituximab maintenance, because it delays the time of recurrence, even if it doesn't prolong overall survival. But some investigators, some physicians may like not to use maintenance, and you can give our chemo for 6 months, which will be usually shorter than R square. So this is also a discussion you may have with the patient.
So let's hear a follow-up of what happened to your patient. He actually looks like he went into a trial, a phase 2 study of R-squared. Can you talk about what happened once he started treatment?
Well, the treatment was well-tolerated, but I have to explain that the patient actually was really symptomatic by his pleural effusion, so he had to have a pleurosynthesis and some evacuation of pleural liquid. Went okay, came back with after the next 8 days for the next rituximab infusion, was better, continued to improve over the first months with the different rituximab infusion, and no other pleurosynthesis was necessary. We did an intermediate CT scan at 2 months or 3 months that showed still persisting pleural effusion, but we were able to basically continue because there were no symptoms anymore. He was feeling much better doing his daily efforts and daily activities. And at 6 months, when the patient was evaluated with a CT scan, he had reached a CR, which was very interesting and even probably a little bit surprising, because this was really a patient with a symptomatic burden. And we know, for instance, that pleural effusion is usually an adverse prognostic factor in this patient. So we were well surprised in the good direction. The patient then went with consolidation with lenalidomide rituximab for 1 year, had resumed work during the first 6 months, and went perfectly well during this time and perfectly well for the next year of rituximab. And I have seen him like probably 1 month, 1 month and a half ago, and he was 1 year out of treatment and was just fine.
While he was receiving treatment, did he have any problems with dermatologic toxicity from lenalidomide, cytopenias, or GI problems?
This patient really went very well in terms of tolerability. He didn't have any symptoms related to the drugs or the drug administration. As I mentioned, I have seen patients that had really a little bit of more GI problem, like mild diarrhea, which can really be disturbing their daily life. And again, then it's a little bit difficult because it's not a very close dose-effect relationship. So you need sometimes to adjust that and discuss with the patient if they want to continue switch or things like that.
I've heard, I think it's from some myeloma people about, because of course, as you mentioned, they use a lot of long-term lenalidomide, the use of cholestipol, the bile salt absorbing agent. Have you ever tried that in any of your patients with diarrhea?
No, I have never tried that.
So I want to go on and talk about therapy relapse disease. And to do that, can you talk a little bit about this 78-year-old lady and how she presented and what happened to her?
So the case I like to discuss is a lady who is now 78, but came a couple of years to our clinics for an opinion regarding follicular lymphoma that was diagnosed on an abdominal mass, which was 5 centimeters large by CT scan, and discovered, I will say, probably randomly, she had very mild symptoms. Like most of these patients, they feel a little bit of abdominal discomfort or something like that. Somebody does an ultrasound or CT and discovers this lymph node. We are never sure that these symptoms are related to a mass of 5 centimeters. She was at this time 72, and we decided that she had no other symptoms, she had no biological parameters that will indicate some aggressiveness of the disease. Again, it was grade 1-2 follicular lymphoma. So we discussed with the patient, and she said, well, if I can avoid any treatment right now, I will prefer that. And she was deciding to go for watchful waiting for a couple of years.
I'm just kind of curious. I was going to ask you what her attitude was about watchful waiting. I don't know, you know, somehow maybe nodes in the abdomen might make people more nervous than nodes in the neck. You know, I don't know. But what do you do if you had the same situation and the patient was very concerned? Would you have been open to using, say, R monotherapy at that point?
Oh, yes. I believe that for patients with a low tumor burden, the option of watchful waiting or R-mono are equivalent in terms of long-term results. So it's really a question of the patient whether he would like to be reassured by treating the disease or he will like not to have any constraint with treatment, knowing that if he or she is not treated, there is constraint with surveillance. I think that this woman was quite tiny, so she was easy actually to monitor with ultrasound, not repeating a CT scan every 3 months. And that's what she was willing to do, so it was fine with us.
Seems like that was really a good decision because she was fine for, what, 4 years?
Yes, she was without significant symptoms, but at another evaluation, which was, I think, at that time a CT scan, there was a significant progression of the size of the mass. And we decided to use rituximab bendamustine for this lady who had, at this time, 4 years older, so 76, didn't want to have a hair loss and felt that this was the appropriate option for her. We started to have this R-benda regimen. We didn't went through 6 cycles because she started to be a little bit tired after 4 or 5 cycles, had also some cytopenia, and that's something we can encounter sometimes with bendamustine in elderly patients after 4 or 5 cycles have some cytopenia that needs to be carefully looked at. And this was decided to stop after 5 cycles for this patient.
It's interesting, though, again, looking back at her case, if you had the relevance data in terms of the issue of cytopenias, R-squared versus R-benda, it looked to me like in the data there was a lot more cytopenias and problems with neutropenia with the R chemo, at least up front. Was that your take?
Well, I think it's clearly the case when you use R-CHOP. It's probably a little bit less the case when you use R-BENDA. So I think it depends. But after 70, 75, yes, probably the marrow reserve is a little bit less and you may encounter a little bit more issues.
So what was the next step of what happened with this lady?
So this lady was proposed to have a little bit of rituximab maintenance. And she started with her local physician with rituximab maintenance. But after 1 year of rituximab maintenance, she declined to continue and was looking for her next visit to see what her disease was going on.
And then what was the next step? What happened?
So 4 months after the last rituximab infusion, she had progression of the disease. The disease had a very good PR after R-BENDA and R-maintenance, but grew again. So we discussed again with the lady, and she was really not willing at this time, at the age of 77 or 78, to undergo another chemo, which will have been eventually R-CHOP or R-CVP or R-BENDA again.
Could I just ask, I'm just kind of curious, why was it that she did not want to get chemo? Did she have it because of the cytopenias, or what was her experience like with BR that she didn't want to repeat it?
Well, she was, as I mentioned, quite an elderly woman, and she was not really willing to go back to infusion and the risk of hair loss if we were choosing another regimen. Yeah, she got some kind of fatigue and tiredness with chemo, so she said, well, is there any other options available? And by discussing with her the different options, the idea of using edolizumab was brought forward, and she accepted the concept of using an oral drug that will reach a response in about half of the patient, but the minority of patients with a complete response and with some risk regarding the management of this drug, which we do know exist.
So in a minute, I want to go back and talk about the various options that exist today in a patient in this situation with relapsed disease. But can you talk a little bit about what happened to this lady on edolizumab?
So this lady started the edolizumab with a diminished dose because I was a little bit worried regarding her age and the possible side effect of the drug. So I started with 100 milligrams twice daily. The patient was on cotrimoxazole and valacyclovir to prevent infection, which is a recommended option treatment, actually not an option when you use edolizumab and PI3 kinase inhibitors. She developed at about 6 weeks after starting the treatment, marked elevation of transaminase, about 5 times normal values. We interrupted the treatment for 1 or 2 weeks and resumed with a lower dose and were able again to get to a normal dose. And this was fine until approximately 6 months of treatment with edolizumab. But unfortunately, at that time, she started to develop some strange GI symptoms like flatulence and things like that. No real diarrhea and no real something very severe. Also some cough and a little bit of dyspnea and some episodes of fever. We did the complete worktop to rule out CMV infections, rule out some intestinal infections, and couldn't find any reasonable reason why she has developed these symptoms. We stopped edolizumab for about 2 or 3 weeks and restarted again with lower dose, but she called me like 5-7 days later saying, well, the symptoms are coming back. So these are the kind of side effects that we encounter sometimes with edolizumab, which probably is an on-target immunological effect, which unfortunately, because it's a reasonably good agent, prevents the long-term use of this agent in a substantial number of patients.
I don't know if you mentioned, but what was the status of her disease? She was in response?
She was responding. She had about 30% diminution of her tumor mass, so disease control, not reaching really a partial response criteria, but stabilization or diminution of her disease, which was what we wanted to achieve.
So what is her current situation?
So unfortunately, we had to stop edolizumab for quite some time, I think a few months. But then after, there was a regrowth of the tumor, and we discussed with her, and finally we went an agreement to use a diminished dose CHOP regimen, what we call mini CHOP, in a combination with rituximab. And I think there was a very good response to this treatment because she went into a very good partial response this time. She just started maintenance.
So looking back at her case, she had the initial problems with the liver function tests, and then later on, she had these problems with the cough and the GI discomfort, although not actual diarrhea. Can you talk about what we know about the toxicity that's seen? We'll start out with Adela, so maybe get into the other PI3 kinase inhibitors, what the toxicity is, what the mechanism is, because you hear about autoimmune pathophysiology, and how her case compares to other cases or the data we have right now in terms of the toxicities for idelalisib.
So idelalisib is clearly an effective agent, and it targets the intracellular signaling into B cells, but probably target also some signaling into other immune cells. The first side effect that was described with this drug was transaminitis, which occurs in about half of the patients, develops between 1 and 3 months after the introduction of the drug. You need to monitor the patient for that by checking liver tests every week or every 2 weeks, I will say. And if you see an elevation, you should hold the drug and wait until you see the test declining and you can reintroduce the drug at a lower dose. There haven't been cases of hepatic failures. There haven't been very severe jaundice or things like that. But clearly, when you have very marked elevation of transaminitis, you better withhold the drug until the patient gets better. We see sometimes with idelalisib some cytopenia. We do see some patients which have even some profound neutropenia, grade 4 neutropenia, without understanding very well what are the mechanism of this complication. But it usually resolves or can be managed with a little bit of G-CSF. The most severe and, in fact, really reactions that we see are both opportunistic infections and immune reactions. Opportunistic infections have been seen in randomized trials, and they include CMV-related pneumonitis or other kind of opportunistic infections, which we need to be worried about then, learn that, and check carefully the patient if they develop fever during this treatment. It's recommended right now to provide to this patient a prophylaxis of CMV with valacyclovir and eventually monitor for CMV infection every month, and to prevent pneumocystis giverani infections also using cotrimoxazole. So that's the usual way we manage these patients in terms of opportunistic infections. However, other patients developed, as I mentioned, some kind of immune reactions, which is essentially represented by colitis. Sometimes the symptoms are diarrhea, which do not resolve with symptomatic measures. Again, you have to rule out an infection, but sometimes you don't have an infection and you have really a severe diarrhea with an aspect on a biopsy if you do an endoscopy of a colitis with a lymphocyte infiltration. It is thought at the present time that this side effect is related to disequilibrium in different T cells population, including T regulatory T cells, which may have increased in this patient and may provoke this kind of inflammation of the mucosa of the bowel and causing this kind of problem. And you really need to watch carefully these patients because sometimes the diarrhea became severe. Obviously, you have to withhold the drug. And unfortunately, it's very hard to restart treatment for this patient.
So at least in the United States, we now have 3 PI3 kinase inhibitors approved for FL, not only idelalisib, but copanlisib and duvelisib. Can you talk about what we know about these other 2 PI3 kinase inhibitors and how they compare to idelalisib?
So it's easy to talk about duvelisib, which is a drug which is a little bit different. It has an inhibition of both PI3 kinase delta, but also PI3 kinase gamma. Supposedly, because of that, it had different immunological effects and maybe less infections. In fact, when we look at the result of duvelisib, the response rate is roughly similar, maybe a little bit less than 50%, rather 40-45% for refractory follicular lymphoma. And the risk of transaminitis is still present, as well as the risk of infections. I'm not sure about the risk of immune-related events, such as diarrhea and so on, but they exist also under this drug. So I think there is no major differences between duvelisib and idelalisib. Copanlisib is very different. First of all, it's not an oral agent. It's an IV-administered agent. Then it's a PI3 kinase inhibitor of both delta and alpha isoforms. And the side effects are completely different. What you see with copanlisib, you don't see transaminitis to the extent you see it with other drugs. You see with the effect of targeting the alpha isoform, the risk of elevating of blood pressure, but also hyperglycemia. So you need to monitor a little bit more carefully your patients, especially if they have a history of cardiac disease, of diabetes, and things like that. This is easily done, but needs to be monitored. Furthermore, it's an IV infusion, which is given weekly with some pause after 3 infusions. So it's a constraint for patients. The response rate in relapsing patients is probably interesting in the range of 60 to 65% with a good duration of response. However, the patient has to stay on drug for a long period of time. And we haven't seen with these drugs the amount of infections or immune reactions that we have seen with the other PI3 kinase inhibitors. So it's an option that can be considered in some patients, although, again, there are the constraint on coming to the hospital for an IV every week.
When you think about these three agents, is there, in your mind, any way to separate out efficacy? I mean, I know I'm not really saying from a clinical science point of view, but in your own mind, do you think that one might be more efficacious than the other?
Frankly speaking, I don't see a very different efficacy of these three agents. They were assessed in different populations. Some were refractory patients, some were relapsing patients. And you see a response in half or a little bit more than half of the patient, but very few patients reach a CR, probably 10% or less with all three agents. The duration of CR when it's achieved is not necessarily extremely long. And there are tools that we can use for sometimes, but they may not completely change the daily management of our patients. I see them as a tool to bridge from one therapy to another therapy or to wait for another options in patients rather than a long-term treatment for our patients.
So I want to ask you, have you actually used copanlisib yourself?
I have used a little bit of copanlisib in clinical trials, but rarely.
Okay, so, but I wanted to ask you more about the issue with glucose control, because it's been, as I've been talking to people, I'm not really clear. Am I correct in saying it's mainly actually during the infusion? What's the time course of when this happens?
Well, there was clearly during the clinical trial some very strict instruction regarding glucose control. I think it's not a big issue for patients who don't have a disequilibrium in glucose metabolism underlying. So for those patients, you may find hyperglycemia the night of the infusion and the morning after, but it resolves spontaneously, and you may not have to intervene for this patient. You may want to check because sometimes there is diabetes that is not diagnosed in some patients, but I think if you go over that for the first 2 or 3 infusions, you can go without significant monitoring, I will say, for the other infusion, maybe once a month to make sure there is no increased disequilibrium, but having glucose checks the day after will be enough. For those patients who have an underlying diabetes, then you may have to use a little bit of insulin the night after the infusion or the morning after. 1 or 2 days may be enough, but obviously you don't want to provoke a disequilibrium of this diabetes in these patients.
Any way to compare indirectly quality of life? Because this sounds more like a paper toxicity that doesn't necessarily make the patient feel bad. Any way to compare quality of life on adalimumab / duvelisib compared to copanlisib? Do you think there's less toxicity, less complications? The patient feel any different?
Well, I think, first of all, there are some patients on idelalisib and duvelisib that do pretty well for 1 year, 1.5 years, 2 years. So these patients do well, and they have to be monitored again for transaminitis or neutropenia at the beginning for infection, but everything does well. It's a minority of patients, but these patients do fairly well. For those patients with copanlisib, I think there are probably less side effects directly related to the drug and to the side effects provoked by the drug, but there is the issue of monitoring this patient regularly, coming to the hospital every week. And after 3, 4, 5 months, I think it's quite cumbersome for the patient to come every week to the hospital.
You know, we talked about PI3 kinase inhibitors and relapse disease. Can you talk about other options that we have new data on that are considerations and even old options that you consider, you know, radioimmune therapy, for example? But I'm particularly interested in about R-squared. We were talking about it before up front, but also, you know, patient For example, lots of patients like your patient begin on bendamustine rituximab. This patient went on the trial of adalimumab, but another option might have been R squared at that point. So can you talk about some of the other options out there in relapsed follicular lymphoma and how you sort of sort through them?
So there are clearly now more and more options to manage patients with follicular lymphoma coming from rituximab alone, coming for obinutuzumab that can be combined with bendamustine in relapsing patients and has shown to be also efficacious in patients that were resistant to rituximab. And recently, there have been also some studies comparing R-squared to R alone in those patients in the relapse setting. The preliminary data with R-square clearly indicates that this is a very efficient regimen in patients that had failed prior therapy. And there are a couple of studies which have been performed now and are going to be presented for some next meetings, which indicate that the response rate is high. There is about 60 to 80% of patients that respond to R-square, relapse refractory patients. The CR rate range from 30 to 50% depending on the studies, and there is a good benefit. So we have participated to a couple of studies, either with R-square or with a little variation, which was lenalidomide and obinutuzumab. I'm not sure right now there is a difference. There might be a tendency, but there were no clearly head-to-head comparison of R-square versus obinutuzumab lenalidomide. But clearly, my personal impression is that in the relapse setting, it's a regimen that is well-tolerated. Like in the first-line setting, it's not very different. And those patients usually have already experienced immunochemotherapy and they are quite pleased to experience something else. And that's also a good side regarding the tolerability of R-square. Patients respond well and some response are maintained. There are some indications by communications in different meetings that the efficacy is a little bit lower in patients that have refractory disease compared to those that have only relapsed disease, refractory being defined as a rapid relapse after the next treatment, but still some efficacy also in these patients. There is clearly also an indication that patients with early failures after our chemo, patients for whom we know that the outcome can be dismal, can be well managed with R-square and that the results are roughly identical to that of patients treated much later. So I think that giving the current knowledge about this regimen and what will be published probably in the next few months or years, this will become as a main options for patients that will fail immunochemotherapy. There are other options besides PI3 kinase that are under development. There are antibody drug conjugates that can be considered for some patients. Radioimmunotherapy is not necessarily at the peak of use, but has been used and has been efficacious, and there are some new agents being developed. There is one particular agent that is on development, which is called tazemetostat, which is an inhibitor of EZH2, which appear to have a very high rate and response in patients that have mutated follicular lymphoma in the EZH2 gene. There was some side effect, but it's quite an efficient agent in this setting, and it's an oral agent very well tolerated.
You mentioned something about an antibody drug conjugate. Which one?
First of all, there have been some studies with polatuzumab, which is the anti-CD79 antibodies. There is no way to bring it rapidly on the market for follicular, but I think the different trials with antibody drug conjugate have shown some efficacy. These are options to be considered in clinical trials because these are efficacious drugs for our patients.
So one other issue related to relapse disease is the patient with early relapse after frontline therapy. Particularly the number I've heard is 2 years. I mean, you can tell me what you think they're going, you know, after the completion of, I guess that includes maintenance. Can you talk a little bit about what we know about this patient population, how you approach them clinically, and what kind of trials are out there looking at this specific group?
So we do know for quite some time that patients that do not respond well to first-line therapy or relapse early after first-line therapy don't do well. There have been different publications in the field, either looking at the outcome of patients that have relapsed within 1 year after diagnosis or within 2 years after their first treatment. But all of them show the same thing. The outcome of this patient is significantly lower than the outcome of the patient who has a maintained response after their first-line therapy. The first thing that we need to know for this patient is that a substantial number of patients may have transformed disease. So in one of the studies published in the PRIMA study, it was shown that up to more than 30% of the patients with early relapse have a transformed disease. So it's very important in this patient to do a new biopsy and to rule out histologic transformation, which may necessitate a specific treatment. If they don't transform, there are different options available for this patient. One of these options is the use of obinutuzumab bendamustine, especially if bendamustine was not used in first line. This has been recently updated, and compared to bendamustine single agent, there was a significant benefit of using this combination plus obinutuzumab maintenance. There is the options of using another type of chemo. There are some data suggesting that for young patients that are eligible for high-dose therapy and autologous stem cell transplant may be a reasonable option to discuss for those patients. I do consider that for a few patients that have an early relapse with a significant bulk or had only reached a PR and a rapid regrowth of the residual mass. I do think we really need to watch what are the results of R-square in this setting, because this is really a clearly different approach, and it may work well, as I mentioned, from preliminary result in this patient's population, and it may be an alternative option. So the early result regarding the dismal prognosis of this patient was probably, to my point of view, a little bit over-evaluated, and I think that we can clearly identify a group of patients that are not doing that bad, but clearly they need to be managed adequately.
So you mentioned obinutuzumab, and I'm just kind of curious in general how you view obinutuzumab compared to rituximab in general in follicular lymphoma as opposed to CLL. Do you think that obinutuzumab brings an additional advantage in FL the way it kind of seems to appear with CLL?
So obinutuzumab in CLL has shown clearly a benefit over rituximab in terms of disease control when combined to chlorambucil. And I think that when combined with newer agents, it's probably also a better agent with rituximab. The mode of action of the two antibodies are markedly different. In patients with follicular lymphoma, there has been a head-to-head comparison of single-agent rituximab and single-agent obinutuzumab, which didn't show a marked difference, maybe a slightly improved response rate with obinutuzumab, which did not translate in a difference in PFS. There was a head-to-head comparison of rituximab chemo versus obinutuzumab chemo that was published recently. This was a gallium study, which showed a benefit in terms of progression-free survival. There was, however, several confounding factors in interpreting this study, given a higher rate of complication of the patient receiving rituximab bendamustine or obinutuzumab bendamustine, which was surprising to the whole community of hemato-oncologists. I think that the response rate is slightly higher with obinutuzumab and chemo, and the side effects are not necessarily much higher, so it's a manageable treatment. However, the long-term benefit is still a little bit hard to identify. There is clearly a low rate of progression at 3 or 4 years from the published data. Whether it will translate to another benefit in terms of overall survival, we don't know yet. It has been proposed that this will translate into a prolongation of the duration of response by more than 3 years at 10 years, but I think we are still unsure of that. So I think it's an option, especially for young patients with an aggressive disease, and we can use obinutuzumab in frontline instead of rituximab. But it's also an option for relapse refractory patients. So it's, again, a decision with each patient and each physician to discuss which one of the antibody to use.
Let's talk about the rest of our time about a couple of your other cases. Maybe we ought to get into the issue of transformation. Why don't we do that, the 44-year-old man?
This was a young gentleman, a 44-year-old man, who came with a cervical node and had a biopsy of this node, showed actually follicular lymphoma, and at another place of the lymph node, what was called at this time in situ follicular lymphoma, which is now called in situ follicular neoplasia, but there was overt follicular lymphoma. This was stage 2 disease because we didn't discuss irradiation. This was in the cervical area and I think axillary region. And by discussing with the patient, we offered him to be treated with rituximab single agent. And we used what is so-called the Swiss or SAC scheme, which is 4-weekly infusion. He reached a CR, and we continued with one infusion every 2 months for a total of 4 infusions. So the patient was fine and was in CR. We surveyed him regularly clinically, and he came back with a recurrence of a lymph node, and actually he had also a tonsil involvement. And the biopsy demonstrated histologic transformation with really large amounts of large cell diffuse involvement of the tonsil with large cells. So we have a patient here who had been treated for indolent and asymptomatic almost follicular lymphoma by rituximab single agent, went into CR but had a recurrence with histologic transformation. So we do know that with the rituximab now, the prognosis of patients with transformation has been improved. Most data regarding the management of these patients come in patients who have been subjected to immunochemotherapy in the first line. And we have few informations regarding the patients that were either on watchful waiting or on rituximab single agent. Obviously, the use of an anthracycline is mandatory for this patient, and that's what we use. We decided to use R-CHOP. And the patient, after 4 cycles, had a complete response to R-CHOP. So we thought that we may just continue with 2 other cycles and continue to watch the patients rather than using more intensive therapy, which is probably what we will have used if the patient will have been treated with R-chemo before.
And so what's the patient's current status?
Well, the patient has just completed recently these 6 courses of R-CHOP and he's undergoing surveillance. Obviously, you need to watch these patients more like a diffuse large B-cell lymphoma patient. So every 3 to 4 months during the first year, maybe another CT scan after 1 year. And after that, we do only clinical surveillance.
How does autologous transplant fit in as an option in a patient like this?
I really think that autologous transplant should be put on the table for patients with transformed disease. We do know that when a patient presents transformation early after his first-line treatment, this first-line treatment has included chemotherapy, the prognosis is rather dismal and about half of the patient may die within 4 to 5 years. So I think autologous stem cell transplant, although these are older results, have shown to be of benefit for some patients by comparative series. There were no strict randomized trial for this patient, but it's clearly a good way to have a much longer control of the disease for this patient because you need to bring them into CR, and this is very important, and you can probably achieve that by eliminating the residual disease after an induction with R-CHOP or another kind of chemo.
There's, of course, a lot of excitement right now about CAR-T therapy, for example, in diffuse large B-cell lymphoma. What do we know about CAR-T in transformed FL and CAR-T in FL?
So CAR-T is clearly a major change, probably in the way we start to manage our patients or we'll manage them in the few years. If we talk about follicular lymphoma itself, the experience of CAR-T is limited, but the group of University of Pennsylvania reported a handful of patients with very good results because the response rate was very high. This was clearly refractory patients. They were reaching a CR in 80% of these patients, and this CR were maintained for many months. There are ongoing trials by different pharma companies with different CAR-Ts ongoing for this patient with recurrent follicular lymphoma who have failed 2 lines of therapy or early recurrence of the disease. When the disease transformed, patients with transformed follicular lymphoma were actually eligible for the ZUMA-1 trial. Some patients were treated also in the Juliet trial or other studies with CAR-T. And the result of patients with transformed follicular lymphoma identical or in the same range of efficacy as the other patient with diffuse large B-cell lymphoma, which means that the majority of patients will achieve a response between 50 to 80%. We still exactly don't know what is the variation of this response rate. Maybe 40% of the patient will reach a CR. And if this patient has a CR at 3 or 4 months after the infusion of CAR-T, the preliminary result indicates that this patient may really enjoy a long-term complete remission. So I will say that at the present time, it's clearly an option for transformed follicular lymphoma, For patients who do not respond to chemotherapy, it's a little bit early to say if we can replace immunochemotherapy by CAR T in this kind of patient.
I'd like to finish out with your 55-year-old patient. What an amazing story. I want to hear your theory about the biology, what happened here. Can you talk about what happened with this patient?
Well, this is always an interesting story, and I bring that always to the mind of younger physicians and people less experienced with hemato-oncology. This patient was treated many years ago by chemotherapy, R-CHOP, and because he had a partial response and there was a discussion regarding the optimal management of this patient, he was offered to have autologous stem cell transplant at this time with a beam conditioning regimen.
So I point out that this is 2004, 2005 you're talking about.
Yes, exactly. This was just the time where we started to use rituximab CHOP, but because he had really not an optimal response, we decided to go for that. And this patient went into CR. He was somebody working in public affairs, and he went very well and recovered well. I think he's cycling, and he always sent me pictures of his cycling performance. Unfortunately, about 1 year after autologous transplant, he came back, had an inguinal node. We did a fine needle aspiration of this node, which clearly demonstrated this was follicular lymphoma. We did the workup, and it was kind of almost isolated in the inguinal region, and decided to do only 4 infusion of rituximab and see what will happen before to decide another treatment. And what I can say is that this patient went into CR and never relapsed 12 years later. So I think what we have to keep in mind is that the story of this disease is very peculiar. We may have some clones that are very sensitive to chemotherapy or that are resistant to chemotherapy. We have the way to intervene with rituximab single agent, and it probably involves some immune mechanism of action that may be active at certain time of the disease, not at certain other time, and active again. And I have 2 or 3 patients like that that actually had failed after autologous transplant, and the single treatment they have received was rituximab single agent, and they are in prolonged CR. So we should keep in mind that sometime reusing rituximab as a single agent, or maybe tomorrow with R-square, is a very reasonable option for the patient that may really translate into a prolonged clinical benefit.
I mean, it's really an important clinical point, but again, I'm really curious about hypothesis about what was going on. Of course, this has a very strong immune sort of feel to it. Do you ever wonder, like, what's going on? You think it's possible there's maybe something else, another coincident event, an infection, microbiome things in the gut, some other explanation for why you would see this happen?
Well, I believe there are many explanations, but what we know is that the biology of the tumor cell in follicular lymphoma have undergone a couple of mutations translate into a profound modification of their microenvironment and allow them to escape to the immune control. What we also know is that the disease develops over years and can be detected by PCR years before it's symptomatic. And when we diagnose the disease, we may have only one branch of the history, one branch of the original clone. And when the disease recurs months or years after, we may have another branch. And this branch may not have exactly the same mutations that may impair the immune functions. And it's possible that at some times, immune-based interventions such as rituximab may not work anymore, but may work in another subclones, or may work because the immune status of the patient had recovered. So I think we should keep that in mind, because we follow sometimes patients for 10, 15, 20 years, and they have experienced best maintained remission in the last treatment that included this kind of immunotherapy. So I think it's a lesson for us. We have to be humble. We don't understand everything, but we have to keep hope for this patient, and I think it's important.
This concludes our program. Special thanks to our speakers, and thank you for listening. This is Dr. Neil Love for Follicular Lymphoma Update.